From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast. Welcome to part two of the December 2017 episode of the Bletchley Park podcast, In Their Words. We've been hearing some highlights of the Oral History Project, which gathers veterans' unique and precious memories of the work and the life they had at Bletchley Park and its outstations during World War II. We had so many highlights after 6 years of this project, with more than 400 interviews conducted, that we couldn't fit it all into one episode. So here we are again with a bonus episode. Let's go back to Jonathan Byrne, Bletchley Park's Oral History Officer, with some more of his highlights from this year and the whole project. Often from these interviews, we learn things we didn't know about the process and about what it was like to work here. We might think with more than 400 interviews in the can that we know quite a lot about the processes, but there are still surprises to be had, aren't there?
Yeah.
Brenda Doane's interview is probably an example of that, where she talked about being given more background information than you might think a bomb operator was.
Yes, that was interesting because we hear generally, wherever people work, that they were not given the full picture of what they were contributing to for security reasons. But Brenda Doane, who again involved quite a long journey by the interviewer this time, by Pam Wignall going to Cornwall, and as an aside, Brenda was already a star of YouTube before we interviewed her because she her daughter produced a rather nice little film which you can find, I'm sure it's linked to her Roll of Honour entry, talking about her time as a bomb operator at Stanmore. But what Brenda told us was that they did actually have briefings from time to time on what their work was contributing to. Obviously not the exact details of a particular signal they'd worked on or an operation they contributed to, but certainly they were left no doubt that what they were doing was important, that how it fed into the wider system of Bletchley Park. With the benefit of hindsight, veterans know what they were doing was important. They did at the time sometimes wonder what it was they were doing because they just were not told. So it's nice now that they do know what they were doing. Yeah.
I left school in 1940, just at the time of Dunkirk, before I'd actually finished my education because I didn't take school certificate. My father had been a grocer and I was interested in retail. I was brought up for a family of shopkeepers. So I looked to the retail trade thinking that's what I would end up doing. Now, in 1940, there was no free further education. The war had started slowly and it hadn't gone as expected. Now, in the 1930s, 38, 39, the country was divided between those who wanted peace at any price or rearm. There was always this conflict between France and Germany, and the French had built the Maginot Line, and the Germans had built the Siegfried Line. And there was a music hall song about hanging out the washing on the Siegfried Line. The war started in September. We all thought we were going to be bombed, and we weren't. And it started, as I say, rather slowly. And, of course, the Germans went through the Low Countries, and, of course, we all know what happened to our poor army and Dunkirk. So by the time I left school in 1940, we were waiting for the Germans to invade. They were in Calais. They could see the country. We thought they were going to come across. Whereas the country had been divided in the 1930s with the pacifists and the rearmers, by 1940, everybody was united. The whole country was united. We'd got to beat the Germans. That was all that mattered. There was no free further education. I hadn't done my school certificate. I had no qualifications. If I was going to go into the retail trade, Harrods had a beautiful department store in Manchester. So the only branch of Harrods called Kendall Mills. And so I went to work there. And going straight from school, I started as a junior, which was doing a sort of apprenticeship.
So you were living in the Manchester area?
Yes, we were in a suburb of Manchester. Right. Mm-hmm. And actually, Manchester had one of the first blitzes that was that Christmas, December 1940, I think it was, we were bombed. So anyway, I started at Kendall Mills. But we obviously had to think ahead. And with the war on, everybody had got to do something for the war effort. And I decided that when the time came, I would join the services. But of course, we were expecting to be invaded, so you really couldn't think what the future would be. But as soon as I was old enough, I decided I'd join one of the services. Well, what did I want, the Army, the Navy, or the Air Force? Well, I was a young girl, I was interested in fashion, I was working in a department store. I didn't really think I wanted to wear khaki. Air Force blue was quite attractive, but the caps, the hats, and the uniform I didn't like. But the Navy, the Wrens, had this very nice Navy uniform and the hats. My brother by that time had been called up, and he was in the Navy, and he was in Scotland. And I thought, well, if I'm going to be in the services, I might as well enjoy it. And living in Manchester, the thought of being by the sea and ships. My brother was in Scotland at one of the locks with the combat operations, and I thought, well, this is what I would like. But the Wrens didn't accept everybody who volunteered. So I applied at 17 and a half, and I was lucky. I was accepted, but it always took at least 6 months or longer by the time you'd been interviewed and had a medical. And you just had to wait. Well, the time came and I got my call up and I went to Mill Hill for training. And after being interviewed, I was told I would be joining HMS Pembroke 5.
So you went to Mill Hill for training, and then while you were at Mill Hill, you had an interview as to where you went next.
Yes.
You had no choice.
Well, I can't remember. But it sounded fascinating. Didn't know what it was going to be. The only trouble was it was going to be in London. It wasn't going to be by the sea. But the thought of being in London was quite fun. And then, of course, there was a slight delay for clearance with the police, I suppose, and security. And then we went to Stanmore. I think there were about, I would say, 15 or 20 of us at that time that reported to Stanmore.
And did you know all of the people? They'd all come from your batch at Mill Hill, had they? Or
yes, and I hadn't necessarily seen them or been with them, because I think when I joined up, I can't remember how many there would be, but there'd probably be about 40 or 50 of us that particular fortnight.
So just under half went to Stanmore with you?
I would say there were about 15 went to Stanmore. I can't remember. When we got to Stanmore, we went into a room to be told what we were going to do. And I remember we sat round in a circle. Well, thinking back, I would think that would be, 12 to 15 people, but not more than that.
And what was the point of you sitting round in a circle?
Well, we were told what we were going to do. We'd arrived at Stanmore. The first thing we did was to be told what the job was going to be.
And what did they tell you?
Well, he told us everything about the Enigma machine, about the bomb machine, how it had been invented. He must have told us about Alan Turing.
And he told you all of that?
We knew everything right from the beginning.
Had you signed the Official Secrets Act before that?
I can't remember when. Mm. I presume so. Mm. All I know is that in spite of what you read in all the books about things, we were told exactly what we were going to do. Yeah. We were told how vital secrecy was, that it was going to be fairly hard work, fairly monotonous, but absolutely vital. And the great thing was the timing, because the setting for the disc was changed every 24 hours. We knew then it all had to be done at great speed and at great accuracy, because mistakes were a waste of time. Time meant lives.
If they were telling you then about the bomb machines and what you would be doing, given that you at that point hadn't seen one,
Yeah.
I mean, what did you visualise as what you'd be working on? Did they have a picture?
I can't remember. And I don't remember the first time I saw the machine, which I presume was the next day. But I do remember that we were told very explicitly what we were doing and why we were doing it, why it had to be kept completely secret, and why it had got to be accurate, because it would waste time for mistakes.
What was your reaction to hearing all this?
Thrilled to bits that it was something worthwhile. So positive and so worthwhile. And that lasted right through the war, all the time. We're just so pleased to be doing something hands-on.
Gosh. And, I mean, did you talk about it between yourselves, or did you not even do that because of the secrecy?
We must have talked about it to each other, but I can never remember at any time wanting to say anything to anybody about it. We just didn't talk about it. We just got on with it.
So at that point, before you'd even done anything, you understood the link between where you'd be working at Stanmore and Bletchley. You knew what you were doing at Bletchley.
If we weren't told, we were all intelligent enough to know that once we started, that was it for the rest of the war.
And from what you understood, you'd be at Stanmore constantly. And, and were you? You didn't go anywhere else?
Yes. I don't really know anybody who left Stanmore, because obviously once you knew what you were doing, you did it to the best of your ability.
And you'd get better. And
so you couldn't do more than that.
And more efficient, wouldn't you?
No.
Was there anything you did during your training which could have indicated that you had a particular bent towards this is the sort of work you ended up doing?
No.
There's just nothing.
No.
You all had the same sort of training.
Yes.
No extra tests or anything.
No. I often wondered afterwards how we were selected. The one thing that we all had in common was been to a good school. Now, I had no scholastic qualifications, because lots of people have said, oh, you must have been awfully clever. And that wasn't relevant at all. But we'd all been to high school. Well, of course, there were girls' high schools. Now they're grammar schools. Or boarding schools or public schools. We had a lot of girls from Cheltenham Ladies College and St Mary's Wantage. And we had titled people as well, the odd ones. But the one thing we all had was that we'd been to at least a grammar school. So I'd say we were 11 plus, what were they, 11
so
plus
So you all had a good basic education.
Yes, which I think gave us the intelligence for the secrecy and the understanding of it.
Yeah.
But no, I had no qualifications whatsoever.
And how long were you at Mill Hill?
I don't know. I would think probably a month. We had a fortnight of the initial training. Oh, no, then we were moved from Mill Hill. I think we went to Westfield College in London, because it must have been in between Mill Hill and going to Stanmore. And we had no training at all. I remember one time being taken to a brewery. I suppose it just got to fill the day for us, but we were waiting for clearance. We knew that. And we did first aid, because I remember the officer taking the first aid was a very typical schoolmistress woman, and she treated us all rather like children and said, if you're feeling a bit squeamish, well, put your head between your knees. And she said it so disparagingly that I was feeling that, yes, that's just what I'd like to do, but I wouldn't dare put my head between my knees and have her wrath.
So what were you looking at that could have made you feel squeamish?
Well, talking about first aid.
Oh, I see, the things you might have to deal with.
I knew nothing about first aid, and she just revelled in the things that might happen to you.
So did you have to do some marching practice?
No,
drills at Mill Hill?
At Mill Hill in our initial training we did. But I have to say that after that, I never did any drill whatsoever at all. And at Stanmore, we didn't do any drills at all.
But they must have taught you at Mill Hill about the different ranks in the Navy and how to recognise officers and
those
all that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And were you paid while you were doing your training?
Yes. Well, I think so. I can't remember, to be honest, but I think we must have been paid.
Okay, so you think you were there about a month, and then you were
Let's say a fortnight at Mill Hill and a fortnight somewhere like Westfield College. And I seem to remember that there were some houses around Hampstead that were taken over for accommodation. Now, I was in a house that had belonged to Conrad Veidt. He was a film star, a European film star. And we slept in his house.
This is when you were training?
Yes, but we were killing time. We were just filling in time until we went to Stanmore.
And then when you did go to Stanmore, where were you accommodated?
Oh, at Stanmore.
So everything
Stanmore
was there.
Stanmore was built, I think, specifically for us, because we had four watches, A, B, C, and D, and I was D watch. And I was in the cabin for 48. There was another cabin for 54. I only remember those two. They're just a block with bays and bunks.
So a purpose-built block?
Yes.
So not an Isenhut, it was a block?
No,
a square block.
A proper brick built.
And you called them cabins because you were in the room.
Yes, because we had all naval things. Yeah. As we came in, where they had flew the ends, I think they called it the quarter deck, and we had to salute as we went in. But we had separate buildings, the cabins where we slept, the mess where we ate, the kitchens. And there was a sitting room where we could sit, but hardly ever went in there.
And that was in a separate building again?
In a separate building. I have to say that I can remember no squabbles, troubles or complaints or anything. The food was pretty grim. But because we were four watches, there was always one watch sleeping during the day, the ones on night watch and the ones on evening watch, that the place was always quiet. You didn't make a noise because there were people sleeping, because you wanted it quiet while you slept. Mm. And I seem to remember that the cabins were on slightly raised grounds because we had banks of grass. In the summer, I can remember we would lie out on the grass, sunbathing, and we didn't necessarily have bathing costumes, and of course we didn't have civilian clothes, and we would lie out there in our underwear, petticoats and things like that. And I do remember aircraft coming over. I remember one time lying on the grass there and hearing a little aircraft, and suddenly this aircraft came down. It could have been the Spitfire, I don't know, but a small one. But we all waved, and we thought, gosh, he'll go back to the airport and say, guess what we've seen? All these young girls. We had a lot of fun together, but it was a very happy place.
You could have thousands of people all set up to decrypt and translate information at Bletchley Park, but it's only any good if you've got the information in the first place. That's where the Y service comes in. So you've represented that in your picks.
Yes. The Y service, nobody really knows what Y stood for. Our best explanation, it was short for wireless, believe it or not. But the Y service, which actually was several services, because the Army, Navy and Air Force each had their own organisation doing it. You also had the Radio Security Service, which was sort of slightly separate from the Army setup. You had post office people doing it, and you had people working directly for Bletchley Park, for the Foreign Office. Whoever they were working for, the Y service was collecting the enemy signals and taking them down, and they were being then forwarded to Bletchley Park to be worked on. And of course, the people taking them down, all they heard, or if it was to do with Lorentz teleprinter messages, all they saw was just what looked like random groups of letters, which of course the people then worked on here. So completely incomprehensible, but they all had an idea if they hadn't actually been told that it was enemy signals and somebody was going to do something about it. Enid Wenban, who was interviewed again earlier this year, back in February, she worked at Bow Manor, which was a Y station in Leicestershire. And these places are long disappeared. I mean, they were usually built around large houses, as indeed Bow Manor was, but there were huts in the ground, which have long disappeared. But she was able to give us quite a good description of the setup, of really how Bow Manor looked. And most importantly, of the work that they did. So it's a very interesting account from somebody actually doing the job at the most basic but most important level of collecting the enemy signals that Bletchley Park then did such great things with.
Can I go back to the beginning? Where were you from originally, Edith?
I was born in Wimbledon.
Okay.
In 1920. In 1924, when I was age four, my parents moved to Purley, Surrey, where I was brought up and went to school. I left school when I was coming up to 17 in 1937, and not knowing what to do, I went into the civil service. My father had been a civil servant. Came 1939, yes, the war broke out 2 days after my 19th birthday. A year or two after that, the civil service announced that they would release a quota of girls to be conscripted into the services. We couldn't volunteer, and I managed to get into that. Although my father had died, a friend came to live with us. My mother was willing for me to go. And the contract was our pay would be made up. We must go back at the end of the war. In other words, there would be a job waiting. So I just waited for a letter, and I had this letter to report to a training camp in Northampton in July 1943. And so I trundled off to Northampton, where we went through initial training, drill, PT, uniforms, medicals, IQ tests. And after about that, I made a great friend of a girl there. We became lifelong friends. And after about 3 weeks, she and I were both told we were to join the Royal Corps of Signals and we were going to go to the Isle of Man for 6 months training. That's all. We didn't know anything else at all. So Joan and I trundled off to Fleetwood and got the ferry across to Douglas, where we were met, I suppose, and taken to requisitioned hotels on the seafront there. They take out all the hotel furniture, put in army furniture. Now, we had no idea what we were going to, not the faintest. We weren't told anything. So having got there, we were allocated to 85 squad. there were about 20 of us, I think. And the first thing we had to do was sign the Official Secrets Act.
So you signed that in the Isle of Man?
Yes. And then we were to do training in Morse and E&M, electricity and magnetism, the theory of radio waves, all of which I found quite interesting, actually. And Morse was hard work. But we had drill along the seafront. We had PT nearly every day. That I loved, actually, because we'd go up onto Onchan Head above the sea. We were there right through the winter, actually. But Joan and I were keen on exploring, and on weekends we'd go off round the island. And, of course, I had a bit more money than she had. We had a good time, actually. We thoroughly enjoyed ourselves. But these boarding houses, hotels, there was no hot water. They didn't light the boilers. We had a wash basin in our room with freezing cold water. A bathroom down the corridor, no hot water. So she and I used to go into the town once a week. And for 6 months, we'd have a hot bath at the local baths.
So throughout the winter of 43?
Yes.
No hot water whatsoever?
43, 44.
And was it a cold winter?
I don't remember if it was freezing cold. No. Okay. I mean, we had great coats.
That's fortunate.
And no, it wasn't that bad, I don't think. Well, you see, it was from September to March, so right. The autumn was probably quite mild. I can't remember it. I think I got home for Christmas, actually. So we had to learn Morse, which was quite hard work, and we had to eventually achieve 18 words a minute, I think. And then at the end of it all, we had to pass a test, which are sort of trade tests, which gave us supposedly a few more pounds a week. And we had to learn the international codes. At what point we realised exactly what we were going to do, I have no idea. I mean, we did know, but it was never spelled out to us at any point in time. And we didn't know anything about Bletchley Park until we got to Bomana. A lot of what we knew seemed to be just sort of supposition. I don't remember anything having talks about the purpose of the work or anything like that. But we did know what we were doing, really, by the end of the training.
Weren't you curious in the early part to know where you were going to go?
Well, yes. And, you see, we were told that it was secret or not to talk about it. And I seem to remember they told us not to talk to each other about it.
Oh, yeah.
Now, that was quite interesting. Careless talk costs lives. And it stopped us talking about it outside. Well, we might have been heard. I think that's what they told. But we didn't want to talk about it. We're much more interested in what we're going to do next weekend.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure when you're under training, there's nothing to talk about because you're all getting the same training.
Yes.
And being young girls, there was nothing really to talk about.
But, of course, when we came home and people said, what are you doing? I always said, oh, I'm sorry, I can't talk about it. And people were very good. They never probed. They never asked questions.
There are two of you on the course, you and Joan.
Yes.
Who are going to Bow Manor.
Yes, we were both posted to Bow Manor.
Okay.
Actually, I was surprised that she actually passed the course. She never took to the work. The morse drove her mad. And after a bit, or almost immediately after we got to Bow Manor, she asked to be put on something else. She was sent to Knockholt. You'll know about Knockholt.
Yes.
And what exactly she was doing there, something much more menial. She wasn't taking morse anyway.
You finish your time at the Isle of Man?
Well, yes, and then I presume, I can't remember exactly how it all happened, I was told, well, Joan, that we were to go to Loughborough, where I suppose we were met. I've got no recollection of actually arriving there at all. We were accommodated in huts, Garrett's Hay. Now, there's a picture of Garrett's Hay house. And that actually was originally the vicarage. You can just see the church across there.
Yes.
Just down the road from Bow Manor. That had been requisitioned. And admin staff were all in there and other people. But we were accommodated in three huts with 12 to a hut.
In the grounds?
Yes, yes. And there was a separate building with a cookhouse and the dining room, and then there was a naffy hut where you could go and buy chocolate and things. I mean, it was a complete camp. It says here, did you have to walk to work? Yes, well, we did awful shifts, but they were called watches because our commanding officer, whose name I can't remember, had been in the Navy. He was a commander, and he transferred to the Army as a colonel. And all the cartoons and the jokes, he was wearing two hats, of course. And so we didn't do shifts, we did watches.
Right.
And we did four different watches in 3 days. It was diabolical because we had no sleep pattern at all. And then a day off. But to get to work, you all know about Bow Manor, I'm sure. It was set up as a sort of farm. I think they had animals grazing there, I can't remember. We were working in huts, I hut. And to get to work, we had to muster at the camp and then walk across the road, up a footpath, over a stile, through a wood, about 100 yards through a wood, out on the front of Bow Manor Quadrangle, through that, out the other side and across a bit of grass to the hut. In all weathers, pitch dark sometimes, but everybody carried a hand torch, of course, in those days, in the blackout. It wasn't very good when there were horses gathered around the stile. We had to shoo them off.
Gosh, you can remember that walk so well.
Yes, I can. I can. We were in these three huts, 12 to a hut. I mean, we made very close friends in those days because we saw so much of each other. We all got on so well together, actually. And we did these four shifts. We'd have a day off and a morning off and then be on from 2 to 8. Go to bed, get up the next morning, on from 8 to 2. Go on that night at midnight till 8 o'clock in the morning. Go to bed. Of course, you come back. I've been working all night. You'd be given breakfast, not supper. And then to bed and then on from 8 in the evening till midnight, and then a day and a half off. So there was no pattern to it at all. It was awful, really. That's something I hated. It would have been far better if we had done several days of the same shift at a time.
Oh, I see.
But we didn't.
There was a pattern of sorts.
Well, yes, yes.
Yeah, but,
so we,
and but
we
not did, a logical one to
I
you.
I was on Sea Watch, and they were all together, so I think we were about 20 mostly. It must have been 20 sets in pairs down each side of the room. And we'd have to go and take over from the previous watch, A, B, C, D watch. Now, we didn't have anything to do with the other watches at all. Two of them lived at a distance and were bussed in each time, but we literally took over from them. And we had, I must tell you about our supervisor, who was a sergeant, James, Jimmy James, and I caught up with her on one of the reunions. She was a very nice woman. We were very fond of her, and she supervised and told us what frequencies we were to listen to. And presumably she was in touch with the I Corps people in the Manor House, but we never knew that, you see. We were never told how the thing works. But we took these messages, blocks of five, as you probably know, and they were sent to Bletchley Park either by dispatch rider or teleprinter. I think we were told dispatch rider. We knew Bletchley Park as Station X.
I was just going to ask you
we
that.
We did know about Station X right from the beginning then.
Did you know what Station X was?
Well, we obviously knew that they used the messages we sent, but we didn't know any results, of course.
But you didn't know it was at Bletchley?
We knew vaguely where it was, not precisely. Oh, and we didn't know the name of Bletchley Park, no. We just knew Station X, where all this stuff went.
When you arrive for your shift, the girls who have just finished their shift, they're there. Do you sort of take over in the middle of a message?
Yes, and you'd have earphones. One girl would have one earphone, I'd have the other earphone, and we'd have to actually take over in the middle of a message. Yeah, that did happen sometimes.
Amazing.
But then, of course, there were times when you were sitting for a long time waiting for the next message. There was a lot of boredom to it, really.
Mm-hmm. It's probably a silly question because I know they're just letters and numbers and random. None of it would have made any sense to you, I imagine.
Oh, no.
Right.
No.
You never got a free text message coming through.
Not till BE Day.
Oh.
And I took a message from a U-boat surrendering.
Oh, did you?
In plain language. Here ist U and a number and figures, obviously giving the position. Kapitän Heinschmidt or some such name. I can't remember the name. Yes.
And you took that message?
Yes. Mind you, I wouldn't have been the only one. The naval people would have taken that, I'm quite sure.
Well, I'm sure. But it's interesting for us to record that.
Yes.
But for the rest, you're just taking these blocks of fire.
Yes.
That must have been very monotonous.
It was tedious, but it took a lot of concentration and skill and using the sets, because very often you were listening to something with noise on top. And you had to concentrate very hard. But the thing is, we were very much aware that we were doing something of vital importance, you see.
How were you aware? I mean, did people reassure you and tell you this?
Well, we knew we were listening into the Germans by that time.
Right.
For goodness sake, you know, we couldn't not know.
No, of course not.
And going to Bow Manor and seeing the aerials there, these huge dipole areas, they must have chosen places quite carefully, where they could get signals from right across Europe, of course.
Mm. Did you ever get any feedback of what you had received, of the work that you had done? Did anybody ever say, well, Enid, you know, that message that you received the other day turned out to be so-and-so?
It happened to one girl, that's all I remember, who received some congratulation for something that she'd done. But you see, that was completely at random. She didn't do anything special.
No, quite.
That was probably somewhere near the end of the war. I don't remember what that was. But no, nothing like that. But, you know, we all felt that we were doing our bit for the war. That's what mattered.
You said that you knew that all the information was going by dispatch rider to Station X.
Yes.
How does it work? Do you sort of spend your whole shift listening to all this and writing it down, presumably with a pencil?
Yes.
Is the paper then taken away immediately, or does it accumulate?
We all had a basket on the top of the set, so you simply put the completed message in the basket and they were collected and they went. That's all we knew.
So as you write them, someone comes and collects them?
Well, not immediately, but
But they don't accumulate to the end of your watch.
Yes.
And these dispatch riders, were they going all the time?
I have no idea. We didn't see them.
Oh, you didn't?
Oh, no.
Oh, okay.
I mean, that was from Bow Manor House. All we saw Bow Manor House was when we walked to work and back. That's all. We never saw anything else that went on there, because we lived across the road at Garrett's Hay, you see.
I'm getting a picture in my mind of quite an industrialised process of receiving all these messages all these girls with their sets on and so on.
Yes.
Which is very efficient, but on a human scale sounds very boring.
Well, yes.
Tedious.
I suppose so, but it was quite challenging, really. There were those who would always listen to the same frequency and they'd recognise the hand of the sender.
Is that right?
I can't remember that happening to me particularly, but some of them said they knew. Yeah, I mean, a lot of it's hazy now, really.
I think you're doing rather well. Clearly you kept it secret. You never spoke to anybody.
No, no.
That's a given. And I think it's remarkable of your generation that you did.
That's right.
But when did you get to hear that the secret was out?
1974, Ultra. The book at the bottom.
I know the one you mean. Yeah, this one here.
Winterbottom.
The Ultra Secret by Winterbottom.
Now, how we knew, Pam and I, how we knew that had come out, we must have read about it in the paper.
Uh-huh.
We were absolutely dumbfounded. We could not believe that all that stuff was coming out into the public domain.
Uh-huh.
We really were staggered. We would never, never, never have spoken of it to anybody. And from then on, of course, we started going to reunions, and that was a revelation.
It's an easy trap to fall into, just thinking about the war in Europe, but there was a huge endeavour to break Japanese codes here at Bletchley Park, and you've picked somebody who was involved in that as well.
Yes, Mr. David Bentcliffe, interviewed in January of this year. He was a naval officer, a very young naval officer, a midshipman. When he joined the Navy, was then sent to Bletchley Park's sort of own in-house training school located in Bedford, where he did a Japanese language course. As a result of that, was then posted to Bletchley Park, where he was working on Japanese naval codes. And he describes, as you will hear in the interview, really how they did this. Because if you think about with Japanese, you've got a different alphabet or alphabets, as well as the different language. So the whole process of how Japanese was represented by the Japanese using the Latin alphabet that we're used to, but then how you then had to not only deal with the deciphering, which was the most difficult bit, but then translate it into English and get something out of it. So a good description from Mr. Bentcliffe of how that was done.
We heard some of the details about how people were trained in Japanese from our archivist, Guy Revel, in our Enter Japan episode. So if you want to go back and find out a bit more about that, that episode lives on. That's not all Mr. Bentcliffe had to share with you, though. He had some more sort of practical details about life around the work.
Yes, again, it's these lost details, just as, you know, the makeup of Bow Manor. You know, the hut he worked in, he was almost certainly in Hut 7, which disappeared very soon after the war. And we have a few grainy photographs of it, but he talks about what it was like in the hut and also where they ate, you know, the canteen, what that was like. You know, when we try to tell this story, as we are doing currently in our off-duty exhibition, it's so good to get this sort of detail about how they lived, the conditions that they were in, what the food was like. It's really funny because, I mean, thinking just about Bletchley Park, you get three stories. You get people saying the food was fine, particularly considering there was a war on. You get people saying the food was awful. Or the one that always amused me is said, well, I don't remember. I've never really taken much notice of food.
not
a great gourmet.
I would remember what the food was
That's
like.
That's right. So whether people perhaps remember a particularly bad meal and that sort of colours their impression. I mentioned earlier on how we want to interview people who are in the local area from that time. If anyone was involved with the catering here, we'd love to hear from them, because how did you cater for 9,000 people?
I was 17, and in my last term at school, which was in the Midlands, I mean, a boarding school. I was taking Latin, Greek and French in my equivalent of A-levels, then called the higher school certificate. And the master who taught, he said, would I be interested in learning Japanese? And I said, yes, of course, sounds interesting, really. And I heard no more, and then in August, and I was due to join the Navy on the 1st of September, I got a call to go to a house in Mallet Street, central London. I had no idea where it was, but I found it on a map and went there. And it was a tall Victorian house, and it was full of young chaps like me, men only, and eventually, one by one into what was the interview, And when my turn came, I went in, and it was a huge horseshoe table with people sitting round it. And the chairman asked me my name and details, and he said, "That is right." And I said, "One thing wrong, I'm not 18, I'm only 17. And they were very pleased to learn that. I didn't know why. And then a youngish chap, who turned out to be the chap who later became Professor Keedle, handed me a piece of paper on which were sentences in English, translations of Japanese sentences, all in, you know, our alphabet, of course. And he asked me what the Japanese words were from the English translation. And I did all right except on one, which I suspect others had made a similar mistake. The sentence was, "Our side shot down 4 American planes today." And the sentence, I'm leaving out "our side" for the moment, it was "Beikoku no hikoki o yonki gekitsui seri," which means gekitsui seri. Verbs always come at the end of a sentence, main verbs in Japanese, had destroyed 4 American planes. And I got planes, hikoki. And then when it said American, it said boki or yonki. So I said, "Yonki is American." And Professor Keel said, "Look again." And I realised it was beikoku. And I got it right then. Yeah. And then I went, joined up and did my basic naval training, which because of the war was not done on the sea, but on a lake in Malvern. And while I was there, I was told I had to report to Bedford on such and such a date.
And what year are we talking about now?
1944. And then I went by train to Bedford, where I was met and taken to the house where the teaching took place, and then assigned a billet, which I've shared with another chap whose name I can't remember. And we were then assigned and told we were going to learn Japanese. And it was written style Japanese. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know if you know anything about Japanese, but in those days, much more than now, there were 3 styles of Japanese with different verbs and things. There was the spoken style, there was the written style, and the epistolary style for writing letters with different verbs and things again. And we were told we were going to learn the literary style, which was known as bungo. Go means language and bung means writing. And we spent 6 months there learning it.
So after you finished the course, did everybody pass or did some people fail it?
No, we all passed, as far as I can recall. And then I went home, and then we we went to Bletchley Park. You know, I'd not heard of it, and we were given billets again. Mm-hmm. They're not. We couldn't walk there because mine was in a place I shared with another chap, a place called Newport Pagnell.
So you were bussed to Bletchley, yeah. So after the course, when you were at home, how were you informed you were going to Bletchley Park? Did you get a letter?
Well, they just said I was to go to London, I'd be taken there, and I went on the train.
Right. And were you told at any time what the purpose of Bletchley Park was?
No, we weren't.
You weren't. You just knew exactly what you were going to be doing. That was it. Did you work 9 to 5 or did you work shifts?
I just worked during the day.
So just probably just 9 to 5.
But I don't think we work shifts.
No, right. And what was your introduction to Bletchley Park like? Did a group of you start at the same time?
Well, we were introduced to the head of the Japanese section, a chap called Michael Lowy.
And can you remember which building you were in?
No, it was we were in some sort of wooden building.
Oh, really?
Not in the main.
And were you there the whole time you were at Bletchley?
Yes.
And you think this was Hut 7, Helen, do you? Yeah, yeah.
Yes, I mean, I can remember the house, but we didn't work in it.
No,
yeah,
no.
Yeah.
But the assistant staff were Wrens. I mean, you know, they were all naval women.
Were you in uniform or civilian clothes?
Yeah, no, I was in my midshipman's. I know the first day I went in, I was taken into lunch into the canteen. I was a bit apprehensive because in the Navy, midshipmen aren't entitled to eat in the wardroom of a boat. But there, I was told it was all right. The other thing I can remember is I was given a drink before in the bar outside, and there was a tremendous crash. And then a chap sending me, he said, that must be Commander Tandy making a point. He must have been quite well known in Bletchley because I met a former Wren a few years ago, and she could remember Commander Tandy very much. Mm. They were quite frightened of him,
really?
I gather.
So he was in charge of all the Navy people?
Well,
there.
I think so.
Right.
But
right.
Michael Lowy was the chap who ran our decrypting
section.
Yes,
the bit you were in. So your daily work, when you arrived in the morning, were you given an introduction or were you just expected
Well, I mean, what we did was, as I say, the Japanese naval authorities, we were given their messages in the form that they'd sent them. They used Western numbers because that was much easier. And some of them had been, you know, deciphered, as it were. And we were given a large dictionary, in effect, where what people thought they might mean. And you could tell which were numbers which had been wrongly sent by the Japanese, were known as duff groups. You could tell that because the Japanese correct groups, if you added all the figures together, could be divisible by three. So if you couldn't do it, you knew it was a duff group.
Oh.
Does that make sense?
Yes. Yes.
When things are written in our alphabet, they're called Romaji.
Right.
They were numbers, as I've explained.
Right.
They stood for Japanese words. In many cases, Chinese versions of, I mean, the Japanese pronunciation of Chinese characters.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I mentioned the word hikoki as an aeroplane. That's he flying, koki, and ki at the end means a machine. So it was an air-flying machine.
Yeah, literally, yeah. When you arrived at work, what was your day like? What did you do?
Well, we spent the day doing our work, trying to work out what the Japanese text was and then translating.
And did this come to you on a piece of paper or little strips of paper?
Well, we had these things with all the numbers in, and some of them had been deciphered and others, you know, you could help by putting your thoughts, putting the Japanese word which would fit in and so on.
So a little bit of educated guessing. Yeah. What did you do with the information then?
I don't know. It was handed on.
So what other sort of thing did you do? Did you just translate all day long? Or?
Yes, that we did talk to ourselves about the work we were doing.
Yes, so you sort of exchanged ideas.
Yes, yes.
Uh-huh. And, I mean, did you find it interesting? Or?
Yes, I did. I found it rather difficult. You know, I mean, testing.
And when you went in to your office, did you have your own desk? Or did you had your own desk?
Yes.
Okay. And on your desk, did you have a sort of an in basket with lots of bits of paper?
No, I don't recall anything like that.
No? And when you did your translation, you just put it somewhere and it would
yes, that's right.
disappear.
Yes,
basically. You didn't see anything come in and you didn't see it go out.
No.
Were you doing the same thing day in, day out? Was it always the same type of work? Yeah.
I wasn't minded there were other things, but I can't recall them. I'm sorry to be so dim.
No, you're not at all. You just used your brain and a pencil and some reference books, and that was all the equipment you had.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
Did you finish at Bletchley at the end of the Japanese War or before?
Well, of course, we still carried on after VE Day.
Yeah.
But then the war suddenly stopped as soon as the bomb was dropped. Mm. We all went our various ways.
And did you actually leave the following day? Or did
almost.
You?
Well, you can understand why.
Were there celebrations when that happened?
Oh, yes, of course there were.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we had no idea that nuclear weapons would be dropped.
No.
We thought it was going to be a long, drawn-out...
When did you find out there were nuclear bombs? Did you know straight away?
Well, we were told.
Straight away?
Straight away. It was in the news. Well, we weren't sure whether it was a good thing or, you know, whether it ended the war. I think our feeling was that it probably saved, although it killed a lot of people at the time, it probably saved not only... our lives, I mean, Allied lives, but it's also a lot of Japanese lives too, because they would have held out tremendously.
Yeah. Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and Catherine White and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, don't be shy. Write us a ripping review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.